This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris and you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Joining us on the show today is the US Ambassador to Malaysia, Her Excellency Kamala Shirin Lakdir. Good morning, Your Excellency. Welcome to the show. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Now, the last time you were here on The Breakfast Grill, it was before Malaysia Baru, still under the previous Barisan National Administration. Now, the US had previously cultivated a very close relationship with the Najib administration. How do you think U.S.-Malaysia relations will pan out under Tun Dr. Mahathir?
So from the day of the election on May 9th, 10th, I think both the U.S. government and the embassy here, we respect the vote of the Malaysian people. We support their decision, and it was clear that they had selected a new government, and we felt that we were going to support the Malaysian people's choice. Mm-hmm. And so since that day, we put out a number of statements after the election in support of what had happened and our commitment to the relationship, which is really based on people-to-people sort of support and engagement. And because of the nature of our own democracy and our own experience of changing government, mm-hmm. We are very comfortable that our relationship is still very strong, and it's very comprehensive partnership across lots of issues and concerns.
So you said people to people. What about government to government? How is that relationship?
I would say it's very, very good. I've had the opportunity to meet the new prime minister very early, and then I met him again with Secretary Pompeo when he came to visit. I've met many of the new ministers very early, and we are already working together very closely. And the pillars of our relationship remain very strong, whether it's economic or security assistance, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's education, whether it's public health, environment, you know, wildlife trafficking issues, trafficking in persons issues, cybersecurity, financial crime. These are things that we are closely working together, government to government. And in fact, I think going forward, we're working even more closely. And I see in many areas that we will strengthen and enhance the relationship.
So was it fair of a comment for me to make earlier that the U.S. had previously cultivated a strong relationship with Najib Razak? And I was reading commentary that said the U.S. ties were strongest under the Najib administration. Would that be a fair comment to make?
So I think we've always had very strong ties. I think the relationship, I would go back to Prime Minister Mahathir's first term, Mahathir 1.0, that the economic relationship between the United States and Malaysia was very, very strong. And Malaysia's development of an electronics sector and becoming part of the global supply chain, a huge aspect to that was U.S. firms, some of them very famous, Intel, Motorola, HP, who came started developing that along with a lot of European and Japanese firms. And that was really very much under Prime Minister Mahathir's mission of developing the economy here in Malaysia. And I could go on. There are other aspects where we had very strong relations across all the prime ministers.
Well, with Mahathir 1.0, he was never shy about making his opinion known about the U.S. He was never shy to criticize the U.S. Do you think Mahathir 2.0 will be the same?
I think that there are many things where the prime minister we will have frank conversations or things where the United States and Malaysia may not agree. But I think the fundamentals of the relationship and how comprehensive the partnership is sustain us. And there are many things that we are working with the new government on already.
So with the visit of the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to Malaysia earlier this month, it was really fascinating because these two men, Secretary Pompeo as well as Dr. Mahathir, came to power essentially around the same time.
Yes.
Yeah. So Secretary Pompeo in
I don't
April,
know that we think.
Sorry,
we don't call
me.
It.
Let me rephrase that. Essentially came to office around the same time.
Came into their positions.
Correct.
So I think Secretary Pompeo very much wanted to come As you know, he was going to Singapore for the ASEAN Regional Forum meetings, but he wanted to come to Malaysia. It was a brief visit, but he wanted to meet with the new prime minister and wanted to congratulate him on the election and also reaffirm our commitment to the bilateral relationship. I think this was the first opportunity for the secretary to meet both with the prime minister, and then in Singapore, he met with the new foreign minister. Mm-hmm. And they also, Malaysia and the United States have been ASEAN partners, so they were going together into a meeting between all the ASEAN foreign ministers plus the U.S., and they were partners in that meeting for the last 3 years. Malaysia has been our ASEAN partner. So I think he really wanted to meet the prime minister and to hear from him his priorities and objectives, and also to reaffirm the relationship and begin a relationship with the new government.
So you were there at that meeting?
Yes, yes? I was.
So what were some of the main takeaways from that meeting?
I think for me, and it was their conversation, so I'm a little bit reserved, but that there are many concerns and issues that we share together. Some of them are our traditional strengths in the relationship. Some of them are looking forward how we can work together. They also talked about regional security issues, which and commitments that we have both as members of the UN. And so for me, it was an opportunity for them to meet each other for the first time, but also to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to the government, which, of course, for us, the Malaysian people elected the new government. And I think they explored some of our issues of greatest concern.
Which were?
They talked about economy and trade. They talked about regional security, North Korea a little bit. Talked a little bit about our cooperation in law enforcement, in counterterrorism, cybercrime. So very broad topics.
Following that visit, I believe most analysts were hoping to learn about the allocation of U.S. resources, specifically military resources within this part of the world, if more would be deployed here. Did anything come up from that?
So I wouldn't speak on what happened in the meeting, but I would say more largely, we already and have had for a while a very strong military-to-military relationship with Malaysia. A lot of our cooperation in military, sort of the military pillar, is very much in capacity building. So professional military education, we have Malaysians who attend our academies. They also attend our National War College, Army War College, Navy War College. So many senior leadership in Malaysia have attended a professional military education in the U.S. We also do exercises that build capacity and interoperability between our militaries. In some cases, they're multilateral. The one I'm most proud of is Pacific Partnership, which is an annual exercise, which is regional, so it brings in different militaries in the region. It also has a piece of bringing in civil authorities, particularly first responders and emergency preparedness. And what this is planning for a disaster in the region and how the U.S. military and the Malaysian military and other militaries could respond. This partly is built out of the tsunami in Indonesia and how and it also the U.S. military at the time re-looking at what can we do regionally to respond quickly and with our partners. This year, we had the hospital ship, the Mercy, visit Klang and also Sabah. And we also have this smaller type of vessel that is more like a ferry that can quickly go to respond to a disaster. And that ship last year went to Kuching for the first time.
Well, if you could very quickly explain a little bit. So Secretary Pompeo was in this part of the world to flesh out details of the Indo-Pacific strategy, right? Can you elaborate where India plays into this Indo-Pacific strategy, where Malaysia plays within this strategy?
So Malaysia is, of course, part of the strategy. This is a U.S. strategy. So Malaysia, as our bilateral partner, but also a member of ASEAN and a part of an important leader in the region in general, but specifically in ASEAN. India has already been part of some of the regional architecture. They have participated in APEC, in different, in ASEAN regional forum, and different. So I think it was a recognition of how India is part of the region, both economically in terms of security. And I think Malaysia certainly has very strong relations with India, and so recognizes the role they have in terms of trade, economy, security. For us, we defined, and this is the four pillars of Indo-Pacific strategy in the economic realm. Let me see if I can do this properly. Cybersecurity is one. Energy is one. Sustainable infrastructure. And digital economy. And in actually, we are already bilaterally working with Malaysia on many of these. Digital economy and energy issues, cybersecurity. We have very close cooperation with Malaysian government and also some of our companies who are here focused on cybersecurity.
So I'm just wondering whether the inclusion of India in this Indo-Pacific strategy, whether that has to do with the string of pearls, right? The military and the trade intentions from China within the Indian Ocean, and where India, you know, working with the U.S., can be a counter to the string of pearls.
So for me, including India in the way in the strategy for us is accepting the reality of what has happened in terms of India's relationships across the region. So I think it is for me that when I look at it, I think it is obvious that India has to be part of the larger strategy, both for the region, for ASEAN, for Malaysia, as well as for the United States. And that relationship, India's participation in the economy and trade, and also security, and the reality of shipping, which you just defined, the Indian Ocean, the reality of security for the entire region is to somehow say India is not part of the dynamics, particularly the economic dynamics, is ignoring reality.
But how important is India to that? Because it really is the middle power, so to speak, between China and the U.S.
Well, I always like to think of ASEAN as a big power.
Collectively.
Collectively. And that is collectively. And as we go forward, because this is – I always think of it, so you are saying this is a strategy for the future. It's not for today. So collectively in how ASEAN develops itself, how ASEAN as a trade and economic sort of grouping, as well as a security grouping, as well as a regional grouping across all sorts of issues, and how India develops its relationship with ASEAN. So I look at ASEAN as having great potential, and so don't count them out.
I'm speaking to Her Excellency Kamala Shirin-Lakhdar, the U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. After this, we'll take a closer look at the Trump administration's engagement with Asia. Stay tuned to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Thanks for staying with us on The Breakfast Grill. I'm speaking to Her Excellency Kamala Shirin-Lakhdar, the U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. Picking up where we left off, Ambassador, taking a look at the U.S. President Donald Trump's more than a year and a half in office now, how would you characterize his foreign policy approach?
So I think his administration and President Trump has paid a lot of attention to Asia-Pacific region. Some of his cabinet, their very first trips were to this part of the region. As we all have seen, his focus on North Korea, both his cabinet, Secretary Mattis, Secretary Pompeo, before that Secretary Tillerson, and the president himself has focused very much on North Korea and the how we can deal with North Korea as a region and globally, and also, of course, UN Security Council resolutions that relate to North Korea.
So his approach to North Korea, compare that to, say, his approach to the Iran nuclear deal. Is that sending mixed messages to the international community?
So I would say there are fundamental concerns about the nuclear programs, that the nuclear program in North Korea and where North Korea has gone. They also have a ballistic missile program of great concern. Iran, as you've already seen, there's another set of issues. There's also regional concerns. So I think in both cases, the fundamental global and international concern about the nuclear programs and the missile programs in both countries are similar. There's, of course, Iran is very different than North Korea. There's regional dynamics that are very different. So I wouldn't like to directly compare, and we could probably spend another hour on this topic. And I think in North Korea, we still have a lot more to do. There's a lot more focus on what negotiations will happen. The administration has been very clear to everyone that the UN Security Council imposed sanctions need to continue.
Has there been progress on that front in terms of the denuclearization program?
Well, they are still from the U.S. side, there is a lot more to go. There's a lot more of discussions. And I am not a North Korea. I'm not central to this. So I think it is very clear there is a lot more to do and that the U.S. is very concerned that North Korea live up to its commitments. And at the same time, that until there is much more progress, that the international community needs to continue to implement the U.N. Security Council sanctions, and that North Korea really has a lot to do both in denuclearization and related to ballistic missiles.
So since we're talking about President Donald Trump's approach to foreign policy, if I could say bring in the U.S. State Department, for instance, I mean, traditionally foreign policy has been led by the State Department, but there's been a certain level of, shall I use the word, turmoil within the State Department recently, coupled with President Donald Trump's propensity for tweeting. How has that impacted the U.S.'s foreign policy?
So I think that there is historically the White House is and the National Security Council in every administration, but every recent administration has played a very strong role in foreign policy development. So, and usually in concert and coordination with both the Secretary of State and often, depending on the issue, other cabinet level officials such as Secretary of Defense, among others, and on trade issues, U.S. Trade Representative, Treasury Secretary. So often at the National Security Council, which is part of the White House, plays a coordinating and policy development role across administrations for the last decades.
Okay.
Secretary Pompeo, so going back to North Korea, as you know, he was head of the CIA, and he had been working with that interagency, we call it interagency process or National Security Council process on North Korea. And so when he became secretary, he carried forward that role. And I think he had been working closely with President Trump and other senior officials on the North Korea issue. So in some ways, that transition was smooth. But I think Secretary Pompeo now, of course, he's had to pick up all the other issues within the State Department's preview. He's very focused on making the State Department the preeminent sort of organization in the U.S. government on diplomacy.
Mm.
There are many other players, I named some of them, within our foreign policy. So I think this is something traditional. We are in that our government has many different aspects of its foreign policy.
Right. So everyone has something to contribute to the policymaking.
Right. Sometimes we fight, but that's okay. It's a wrestling match, and hopefully we come to a conclusion.
Whose voice is louder, perhaps?
Whose headlock is strongest. But I won't go there.
Let's leave it at that. I do want to say, though, that it's really timely for you to come on The Breakfast Grill this week, given that Tuesday was really quite a day, one of the worst days, I would say, for President Trump in his 19 months in power, with his longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleading guilty, and simultaneously his former campaign chief, Paul Manafort, also being found guilty. Ambassador, help frame this for a Malaysian audience, the significance of the Manafort and the Cohen cases.
So I don't know. As I always say to Malaysian audience, you can ask me any question, and I the worst that can happen is I say I really can't answer. So at the specific question you just asked is, what does this mean and what will happen next? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But to step far back, what I would say to Malaysians is that, and I have said this for several months, more than a year now, is what you're seeing in the United States is an aspect to our democracy and our rule of law, and also that we have the challenge of independent institutions. The challenge that we have prosecutors, a Department of Justice, an FBI that are supposed to carry out independent investigations separate from politics, and that there is this what I call the bright shining line, which they are doing their work, and that it is not supposed to be influenced by politics. Of course, it is easy to say that, but carrying that out and pursuing rule of law and independent institutions requires the individuals to do this. It is not like an institution stands alone. It is the people in them. And we have a particular kind of government in the United States based on our Constitution. And so we live this and this is partly what's happening, and that everyone gets a fair time for the investigation, has their own lawyers, they have a fair outcome, and that it's based on rule of law.
Right. So for an
And why do I bring this up right now? Because I think Malaysia understands this, because Malaysia has just elected a government that is interested in good governance and rule of law and independent institutions that protect individual rights.
Right. But for an international audience, Ambassador, watching what's happening in the U.S., do Tuesday's events reflect a wider destabilization of U.S. politics?
So no, I think Tuesday's events represent that there are investigations, and that if individuals have that come to conclusion, and then individuals are brought into court, a case is heard, there's a jury, 12 individuals, Americans, who are peers. And so they make a decision based on the evidence. And one outcome is that they have a fair hearing, and that individual is found guilty on certain charges and not on others. What you are seeing is a legal process that continues on, regardless of who the individuals are.
So could the president then be in legal jeopardy?
We don't know. There is, you know, and I think I certainly don't know, because I'm not a prosecutor. I'm not aware of what's happening in the investigation, because I'm not supposed to. That's part of the bright shining line. So as you can see, that individuals are undertaking investigations, and it is not publicly known what is happening. But for me, I look at this is a process that we're undergoing, and that it's based on rule of law.
Well, I guess we'll have to have you back in 6 months to tell us more about this. Unfortunately, Ambassador, we've run out of time. But thank you so much for being on The Breakfast Grill today. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
I've been speaking to Her Excellency Kamala Shirin Lakhdar, the US Ambassador to Malaysia. I'm Melissa Idris, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill right here on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan Malaysia's mobile data service provider of the year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.